There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
Hi, I'm Ethan Nadelman, and this is Psychoactive, a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. Psychoactive is the show where we talk about all things drugs, but any views expressed here do not represent those of iHeartMedia, Protozoa Pictures, or their executives and employees. Indeed, as an inveterate contrarian, I can tell you they may not even represent my own. And nothing contained in this show should be used as medical advice or encouragement to use any type of drugs. Hello, Psychoactive listeners. So today's a big day for me because this will be the concluding episode of season 2 of Psychoactive, which means we've put out 80 episodes since the summer of 2021, plus a whole bunch of bonus episodes. And so I thought this would be a good time to really take the opportunity, because I'm not sure if and when Psychoactive will be returning and in what form, to thank a number of people. Let me start with Darren Aronofsky. Many of you know him as the famous movie director. He and I met about 20 years ago. We were introduced by a fellow named Ganga White, who took each of us, not together, separately, on our first ayahuasca experience. But Darren emailed me back in June of 2020 and suggested the idea of my hosting a podcast on psychedelics, actually, he thought. And my response to him was, I'd actually rather do one on all drugs. And he said, let's do it. So first, Darren, thank you ever so much for initiating this project and for having the confidence and the faith in me to make this happen. And then next, let me thank the producers who have put in the most time and effort. Recently, that has been Noam Osband at Protozoa and Josh Thane at iHeart. And then their predecessors who got this going, Katya Kumkova at Protozoa and Benjamin Kubrick. Also at Protozoa, I mean, at the top of the list, Dylan Golden, my key collaborator over there, but also Ari Handel and Elizabeth Giesis and Avivit Bar-Yosef and Eric Watson. And over at iHeart, there's Alex Williams and Matthew Frederick and, of course, the head of the whole enterprise, Bob Pittman. And, of course, Robert Beatty, who came up with a wonderful logo for Psychoactive. So thanks to all of you. It's been wonderful working with this team, and I apologize to those whose names I've forgotten who are working more behind the scenes on all of this. But what I can tell you is the levels of professionalism and time and commitment and good times with the folks at Protozoa and iHeart, the co-producers of Psychoactive, has just made this whole experience a real pleasure. Next, I want to thank you, the listeners. Now, of course, I don't know exactly who all of you are, some of you do tell me, but I can tell you this about the data that we collect. Most of the listeners, maybe 70%, have been in the United States, but there have been listeners in over 170 countries and territories around the world. So the audience truly is global. And I want to thank especially those of you who are listening in countries with fairly oppressive governments where these sorts of conversations that we have on psychoactive would not be so well tolerated in your own countries. I hope these conversations have been a source of inspiration and enlightenment for all of you. Now, as I said, I'm not sure what the next incarnation of Psychoactive will be or when. I am going to take a break for a while at least, but I would welcome your feedback. So contact me through Instagram or other social media or email me directly at ethan@nadelman.net. That's ethan@nadelman.net. I can't promise to get back to you, but I always enjoy getting the feedback, not just the positive, you know, but also the negative and critical ideas for the future. Please keep posting your comments, whether it's on iHeart or Google or Apple or wherever you listen to podcasts. The episodes will remain up for the foreseeable future on all of the platforms. So please keep listening. And so with this, let me launch into episode number 80. And for this one, I decided to ask somebody who's been a longtime ally and friend of mine. His name is Steve Rolls. He's based in the UK. He's British. He has been the senior policy analyst at the British drug policy reform organization Transform almost since its inception, since that organization was founded by Danny Kushlick in the mid-1990s. So he's been there for 25 years. He's widely regarded, not just as an expert in the UK, but perhaps as the single most knowledgeable person when it comes to thinking about the legal regulation of drugs. I mean, that means that he's been a consultant to governments from Canada, Germany, Luxembourg, Jamaica, Malta, Mexico, Uruguay, really almost every place except the U.S. when it comes to legalizing cannabis. It means he's been a recent advisor to the Petro government in Colombia on their proposals for legalizing coca or cocaine. He's been dealing with the Dutch on the issues of legally regulating MDMA. So, Steve, thank you ever so much for joining me on the last episode of season 2 of Psychoactive.
That's my pleasure, Ethan. It's great to be here.
Well, so we have so much to talk about, from models of legalization to the actual realities of legalization. But let me just begin by asking you, I mean, you know, I think some of our listeners will know I've been involved in this issue since the late 1980s. Now, Steve, you jump into this about a decade later in the mid to late 1990s. But when you look at this evolution in the 25 years you've been involved in this, what most jumps out at you?
Well, I mean, I guess like you, Ethan, it's been a remarkable, fascinating journey, because what started as, you know, discussions amongst reform advocates like us has moved from the sort of theoretical space into the real world, and things which were seen as outrageous, sort of extreme heretical views when we started are now very much mainstream political views and supported by a majority of the public. And, you know, they are happening on the ground on every continent on Earth. So things which were impossible not even 25 years ago, even 10 years ago, you know, if you think about it, Colorado and Washington and Uruguay, that all happened in 2012. So that was only just really 10 years ago. And before that, it was just still all theoretical. It was things that we were hoping for. I mean, there were some things happening with medical cannabis and so on. But when you get into the non-medical recreational drug legalization regulation, it's really very much, you know, modern history. And so for a long time, we were, you know, making the case, we were writing our reports, we were developing proposals, we were advocating, we were trying to change the framing of the debate and try and influence key political discourses in the media and in professional forums and in political forums. And sometimes it didn't feel like we were getting anywhere. But clearly we were, because at some point a threshold was passed. And reform became not just a possibility, but a reality. And since 2012, 2013, there's been a kind of cascading sort of domino effect. And you know, from two states in the US to now 21, from just Uruguay, we're seeing cannabis reforms for non-medical cannabis on every continent now. except maybe the Arctic. Well, and we're seeing, as you've already said, we're seeing the debate move beyond cannabis into psychedelics and cocaine and coca and MDMA and other stimulants and other drugs. And so the things that we have been advocating all of this time are becoming a reality. And that is both interesting and fascinating from a historical view, but also, you know, satisfying from a professional view to sort of things that we were convinced that we were right, but everyone was telling us we were mad. It turns out that actually we were right because we've been vindicated by history. And, you know, the evidence is coming in and showing that we were, what we were saying was essentially right. And, you know, here we are. We're still a long way to go, but I feel, yeah, satisfied that we haven't, you know, we haven't, we weren't just some cranky kind of tinfoil hat nutters and heretics. And, you know, history, we are on the right side of history.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, Steve, I'll tell you, part of what kept me going all those decades of being involved in the advocacy, and, you know, when people would think this was just a quixotic enterprise, was the sense that we were right in policy terms. We were right from a justice perspective. We were right from a perspectives of individual and broader morality, and that it just seemed inevitable that somehow this, that on some level, this bubble of a kind of prohibitionist policy, the notion that you could somehow control global illicit commodities markets through policies of repression was somehow going to work. But I want to ask you this. You know, I've oftentimes made the point that if you ask the question, how and why was it that the United States, which for almost a century, really from the early 20th century until basically the second term of the Obama administration, really was the global champion of the war on drugs, right? Exporting and modeling and coercing other governments to adopt, you know, fairly punitive prohibitionist policies. How was it that we nonetheless became the leader when it came to the legal regulation of cannabis? And I've answered that question in the U.S. context by saying it really goes back to medical marijuana. It goes back to that first medical marijuana ballot initiative victory in California in 1996. It was the one that afforded the first opportunity to bring marijuana markets above ground with the medical marijuana dispensaries. It was the one that gave people an opportunity to feel like what regulating marijuana would be like, right? And it helped, you know, in every sense, transform that dialogue in a way that opened up the door, shifted public opinion, shifted government thinking to imagining a world in which the legalization of marijuana, not just for medicinal purposes, but more broadly for all adults, was possible. But the question is, for you in the UK and looking at this globally, to what extent was that the model elsewhere first? Secondly, to what extent was what happened in the US kind of the inspiration or the instigation without which reform would not have happened elsewhere? Because we always look at the Dutch coffee shop system as being, you know, one of the actually pre-models to the U.S. medical marijuana model. And to what extent has this happened in some countries actually totally independently of medical marijuana being the stepping stone?
I mean, that's a great question. There's certainly, I think the fact that the U.S., for the reasons you've touched on, the fact that the U.S. did go first, significantly went first. I mean, I don't want to, you know, erase Uruguay from history here, because Uruguay was the first member state and kind of happened around the same time as Colorado and Washington. But
well, sort of, right? Because in a way, Uruguay legalizes is the end of 2013. So a year after all, after Colorado and Washington. In fact, I sometimes wondered whether or not Uruguay would have happened in 2013 if Colorado and Washington had not gone forward in 2020.
Sure, but the process was unfolding from about 2011, and there were bills being tabled, and it was a very active public debate. Mm-hmm. And there were expert consultations going on in 2011, 2012 that Transform and myself and others were involved in. But I think the thing that was very significant in terms of the US for the global debate was really what you say. I mean, the fact that the US had been the kind of drug war sort of bully of the world for all these decades, going all the way back to, you know, the drafting of the you know, UN single convention in the 40s and 50s and Harry Ainsling and all that ghastly history. The fact that they then did become these world leaders in the cannabis legalization regulation, it did create space for the debate to blossom elsewhere in the world, just because of the US's hegemonic role in geopolitics generally and in drug policy specifically, they kind of lost their authority to bully other countries on cannabis regulation when US states started legalizing. And, you know, when the US does stuff, it becomes okay to talk about it in other places in the world. And you can look at other things like equal marriage, for example. When the equal marriage stuff happened under Obama in the US, suddenly that debate, which had been completely off the table, really, in the UK, suddenly that debate opened up. And within a year or two, we'd legalize equal marriage as well, just because it sort of somehow made it okay to talk about it, kind of normalize the debate. So what happened in the US has been immensely important. And they've, you know, the models that have been adopted have been quite different in many of the states. So there is also this interesting laboratory of change in the US that you have all these different models and we can look at what's working and what's not working. And other countries have looked at that and they've looked at the successes and failings of US legalization and learned from it and developed that and move forward. But I think the political power of the US doing something, even though it didn't happen at a federal level, it still created a political environment in which it became okay for other countries and other political forums to start discussing this. And it became more difficult for the US to sort of try and stomp on other reformers. Because you go back a few years before Colorado and Washington, and the US was, you know, giving the Dutch a hard time about the coffee shops for decades. And then suddenly the US is doing it themselves. And it's kind of like, wow, that's a real change. And I suspect the things that are happening with psychedelics, with magic mushrooms and psychedelic plants in Oregon and Colorado and elsewhere, and things that are happening with Kratom and so on, I think that will probably help open up the debate for psychedelic regulation around the world as well, because it sort of just becomes okay to talk about it. The US, their historical position, their hegemonic position in geopolitics, it just creates a sort of safe space for other nation states to engage in those debates, which just simply wasn't there before.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. But I'll tell you, it's funny when we talk about Uruguay, right? You know, when President Mujica in Uruguay sort of proposed this, and as you said, there had been conversations going on, and folks in the U.S. had been engaging, and then you have, you know, not just Transform, but also IDPC, International Drug Policy Consortium. So there were conversations happening. But what I oftentimes think about Uruguay is that it was a country where the medical marijuana thing had not really developed separately in the way it had in the US, right? So the US opening on medical marijuana, you know, beginning in 96, and then Colorado and Washington obviously opened up space. But Uruguay was an example of a place which moved forward without having ever done that intermediate medical marijuana step, as far as I know.
Yeah, that's true. I think that the one of the differences between reform in Latin America and in Europe and North America is that the key driver of the reform narrative in Latin America has generally been security issues. So it's more been about the cartels and violence and insecurity. And President Mujica of Uruguay, his sort of discourse around the need for cannabis reform, but his discourse was very much around security. I mean, he didn't want to see what he called the Colombianization of Uruguay. He didn't want to see Uruguay become a kind of, you know, move towards sort of narco state type status. So he drove forward. I mean, you know, how much organized crime activity was involved in the domestic cannabis industry in Uruguay is moot, but that was still his driving force rather than you know, economic opportunities or social justice or public health. I mean, those things all came into it. But the driver, I think similarly for the cocaine regulation debate in Colombia now under Petro, is very similar. It's driven not by, you know, the overdose crisis or by mass incarceration and social justice stuff. It's driven more by issues around security and cartel activity and undermining of institutions and violence. So that dynamic is all now beginning to unravel. You know, as the global South is becoming more potent politically, more confident on the geopolitical stage, more willing to stand up to the US and some of the kind of hegemonic powers of the global North, we're seeing a lot more confidence in those countries like Colombia, you know, and like Uruguay, to say, no, we're not going to play this game anymore. We're going to plow our own furrow and do our own thing, because the war on drugs just has not worked for us. We've been fighting your war on drugs for generations, and all it's brought to us is misery and degradation and violence and death, and we're just not going to do it anymore.
Let me stop you right there, because before I want to go back to the sure. Uruguay thing and some of the Latin American context, and I both want to, although I agree with most of what you said, I do want to challenge you on a few things and also provide some context for our audience. So when we're talking about the former president of Uruguay, President yep. Mujica, you know, he was an old leftist guerrilla, Tupamaro guerrillas back in the 70s or whatever, who became this one-term president. Part of what made him successful, of course, was that Uruguay, they never had more than 40% of the public supporting the legalization yep. of cannabis. But they had a leadership, as you pointed out, by President Mujica, and a very strong tradition of party discipline, which enabled this to happen, for Uruguay to pass a law legalizing cannabis a year after Colorado and Washington had done it. Now, you talk about securitization. I think there the big issue was that Uruguay was importing most of its cannabis from, I think, Paraguay, sure. which is the leading producer of cannabis in the southern part of South America, and where organized crime is inevitably involved. But just to complicate it a bit, I mean, I think if we look, obviously, in talking about the bigger issues around coca, cocaine, or heroin, opium, and other places, security is a big issue. But if you look elsewhere in Latin America, I remember we were perpetually frustrated at, you know, more and more people, Latin American, especially Latin American elites, understood the extent to which U.S.-inspired, you know, drug war policies, drug war pressures, prohibitionist frameworks were absolutely a disaster for their country. Sort of like, you know, America during alcohol prohibition times 50 or times 100 in terms of creating, you know, violence, crime, corruption, all that sort of stuff. But we also saw virtually nothing in the way of progress on that front in response to the security issue. And where the progress did happen in recent years, for example, in countries like Colombia, or in Mexico, or even elsewhere, it was typically medical marijuana sort of sticking its nose under the tent, right? In Mexico and Colombia, you have these mothers, these parents of, you know, of infants and children of that terrible Dravet syndrome, that epileptic mm-hmm. syndrome that, you know, where cannabis is the only thing that really helps to reduce seizures. And they become this kind of inspirational force in a way somewhat similar to what happened in the United States. So it seems that even in that Latin American context, where security is such a major issue, and organized crime and the violence and corruption is such a major issue, that nonetheless, apart from Uruguay, it did seem like medical marijuana was the key element sort of opening things up.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on that. Medical cannabis has, you know, it, as you say, it does help normalize the concept of a regulated cannabis market, and it does kind of detoxify the idea of cannabis as this deadly drug in the public perception, and that certainly has played out in most countries, and it's happening in Europe now. I think the thing with Uruguay, I mean, one of the things is that cannabis was never really criminalized in Uruguay anyway. In fact, drugs possession generally was never criminalized in Uruguay, so
Right. Well, and as we forget, and we talk about Portugal, you know, with its decrim model that it brought in about 20 yep. years ago, and we think of them as the pioneer, and in many respects they were, but from a legal perspective, Uruguay already had something of the Portugal model for decades
yes,
beforehand.
Yes,
right?
And they were clearly quite pragmatic. I mean, I actually I met Mujica when we were working there, because it's quite a small country, so your access to the politicians is a lot easier than if you're in a huge country like the US. You can just get to meet the president. And so we went and met him, and it was quite an amusing meeting. But I sort of asked him, I said, like, are you worried about, you know, America breathing down your neck and giving you heat for legalizing cannabis? I mean, are you worried they're going to come down on you hard? And he was like, look, I was imprisoned down a well for 3 years and tortured. He basically said, I don't give a shit about the US. And it was just so refreshing to see just someone literally doing leadership, because it wasn't just cannabis. I mean, this is a guy who also legalized gay marriage and abortion, which, like cannabis, none of them had a popular mandate. He just thought they were the right thing to do. And, you know, he got away with it because the public respected his leadership, even though he didn't have a popular mandate for any of those issues. But, you know, that was just genuine leadership.
I mean, that's true, Steve. But, you know, I'll also say, you know, they had, I mean, I remember, you know, he had a right-hand guy, Diego yes. Canepa, I think, who was, you know, one of our key liaisons. Yep. And I remember talking with him when he had come to the U.S. And I think some of the story can be told now, but they were to some extent concerned how the U.S. would respond, because the U.S. in the past had been so, you know, beating up on Canada if they talked about doing harm reduction, or beating up on Australia yeah. if they thought if they were going to, you know, or, you know, Netherlands or whatever country wanted to move forward. And what he told me was that there had been a discussion with folks in the White House, and he wasn't precise who it was. I speculated that it might have been Vice President Biden, but who had essentially said at that point that, listen, so long as this is entirely a domestic issue in Uruguay, so long as you're not exporting this stuff to the U.S., so long as you're not talking about legalizing drugs other than cannabis, then we don't have to see this as affecting American national security or other political interests whatsoever. In other words, it was a kind of tacit, qualified green light to saying, we're not going to respond to you the way we have in the past. And I think the U.S. ambassador, you know, followed that yeah. line. And then there was another pivotal moment. There was an assistant secretary of state for international narcotics, INL, the State Department Narcotics and Law Enforcement Office. And he was a highly respected diplomat, William yes. Brownfield. And he was something of an old drug warrior, but he had been a very respected former ambassador to Chile and Venezuela, Colombia. He'd become the head of the Narcotics and Law Enforcement Office in 2011. Then Uruguay and Washington legalized in 2012. And the Obama administration is in a bind. Like, what do they do about Washington and Colorado? This is in clear violation of the federal law, in clear violation of the 1970 Controlled Substance Act, in clear violation of the UN conventions. And they kind of toss and turn. And finally, I think the summer or fall of 2013, come out with what becomes known as the quote unquote Brownfield Doctrine. And that Brownfield Doctrine essentially reverses, you know, almost a century of U.S. kind of mono-prohibitionist policy. It basically says we are no longer going to be intolerant of diversity. We are going to be open to other possibilities and debate, so long as countries keep collaborating on the basic efforts to crack down around drug-related organized crime and trafficking and all this sort of stuff, right? So, I mean, as an American, I saw that, you know, Colorado and Washington lead to the Obama administration have to rethink how they're going to have to deal with this domestically, and that inevitably leads to some rethinking of how to deal with this stuff internationally. Now, how did all this look from where you're sitting, you know, advising governments, sitting in the UK, looking at this from outside the US perspective?
Well, I mean, the Brownfield statement was huge. I mean, it was, you know, it was huge within drug policy circles. It got some media coverage. It didn't particularly reverberate around the world outside of drug policy circles. But, you know, it's still being quoted today. And I think you're absolutely right. It was a pivotal moment, because it was basically the US acknowledging that the global consensus on prohibition of all drugs was, you know, crumbling, and they needed to be tolerant of, because the Brownfield wasn't, he didn't just talk about cannabis as well. He talked about the legalization of all drugs or other drugs, jet drugs only. I can't remember the exact wording that he used, but that was really, really significant too. And it created the context for, I think, the debate that has unfolded subsequently. I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see how the what's going on in Colombia with the debate around coca leaf and cocaine regulation is going to stress test that. You know, how far can countries like Colombia push things before the US starts to get pretty jumpy? And I suspect since Petro's election, they have been going, well, hang on a sec, this guy, the new president of Colombia, is actually talking about legalizing cocaine. And, you know, I've been working on this bill that you mentioned in your introduction around the regulation of coca leaf that includes a pilot for a legally regulated cocaine market for non-medical use, very strictly regulated. Go into the details if you want, but it's in that bill. And one of the people who was on the committee that worked on that worked on that bill was Petro, and he is now president. So he spoke in favor of it. It's in favor of it. It's all on the record. He's voted for it. It's all on the record. And, you know, when The Economist did their a feature on cocaine regulation back in November, he then tweeted it, you know, a screen grab of the full the full editorial that was saying, you know, Biden should legalize cocaine. They need to go further than just pardoning a few people for cannabis. So it's going to be interesting to see how the US actually reacts to that. But, you know, if there was a stress test of the Brownfield Doctrine, I think what's happening in Colombia is going to be it. It's going to be really fascinating to see how that plays out.
So, you know, I should tell our listeners that Steve has been the lead author on a number of very important publications. The first one that they wrote maybe almost 15 years ago was basically a blueprint for legal regulation of drugs, called Blueprint for Regulation. But he's also been the lead author on a volume called How to Regulate Cannabis, which is now in its third edition. More recently, a couple years ago, they published How to Regulate Stimulants, which included this issue that Steve's talking about now around coke and cocaine and around amphetamine. And I think also MDMA, and they're currently fundraising to produce a volume about how to regulate psychedelics. Now, this Steve, what I want to go is on this coca cocaine yep. thing. I mean, obviously, coca has been legally produced in Bolivia and Peru for many decades, right? There was always an exception within the UN conventions that allowing them to produce it for, you know, local purposes, but never allowed to export any cocaine except for the kind of decoconized coca leaf that's used as part of Coca-Cola's flavoring and such, and some tiny bit that's used for pharmaceutical purposes, because cocaine still does mm-hmm. have limited medicinal pharmaceutical purposes. But when we look at what's going on now, right? I mean, there's obviously the issue domestically about how do you regulate this. But before we get into that, one of the big elephants in the room always is the United Nations, right? The United Nations, the anti-drug conventions going back, you know, not just to the Opium Conventions of the early 20th century over 100 years ago, but to the 1936 Control Convention, the 61 Single Convention, the subsequent ones in 71, 72, and 88. That was always seen as a barrier to any form of states legalizing markets beyond the research or strictly medical. Now, to go back to Uruguay, I mean, obviously, when Uruguay does this, the United Nations, and by UN, we should specify, there's three major UN drug agencies, right? There's the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, UNODC, which kind of funds programs around the world and whose head is a semi-public figure on drug control. There's the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, which is a grouping of all the various governments that meets, you know, periodically in every spring in Vienna. And then there's the INCB, the International Narcotics Control Board, which has sort of been a watchdog of the conventions. Now, when Uruguay is moving forward and Mujica is saying, we're going to do this and we don't give a damn, and the INCB reportedly sends a nasty letter to Mujica saying, you can't do this. Well, what happened then?
I mean, obviously, they just did it anyway. The thing about the INCB, which is, you know, like you say, they're a kind of watchdog on compliance to the prohibitionist tenets within the three treaties that you mentioned, is that their enforcement power is quite limited. I mean, they can, in theory, make recommendations to more senior bodies within the UN. And that could ultimately result in sanctions or some other kind of punitive intervention. But that's never actually happened. I guess one of the reasons it's never actually happened is because until Uruguay, no country had ever, you know, crossed that line in the sand. You know, Uruguay was the first country essentially to make a kind of hard defection from the treaties. You know, the consensus around global prohibition, including cannabis prohibition, had held for a long time, and the strength of the treaties is essentially based, it's rooted in the fact that member states agree to abide by them. You know, these they're quite difficult to enforce against non-compliance or breaches in treaty commitments. And when Uruguay moved forward with this, it's true the INCB did send them sort of snarky letters, and the head of the then INCB actually referred to Uruguay as pirates, which was incredibly undiplomatic and inappropriate language for a UN agency to be referring to a member state as. But they made an argument that they were doing the reforms in pursuit of the human rights and public health of the citizens of Uruguay. And their commitments to those goals, the higher goals of the UN Charter, superseded technical compliance to, you know, one or two articles in these creaky old drug treaties that, you know, it's worth reminding people, the 1961 treaty, which it's 1961, you know, this is like more than 60 years old now, and was being drafted in the 1940s and 1950s, an era which is completely different, you know, political, economic, social and cultural landscape to the one we live in now, particularly around drug use. I mean, you know, the 60s hadn't happened. And, you know, in the 1940s, you know, Al Capone was still alive. This is when those the foundational bedrock of global prohibition was being drafted. And the Uruguayans basically said, look, this creaky old treaty, it's no longer relevant. We think that our commitments to peace and security and health and well-being of mankind that are enshrined in the overarching UN Charter are more important than technical compliance to these creaky old treaties. And we are going to, essentially, they said, we're just going to ignore them. And we will engage in a constructive debate how to resolve these tensions. And that kind of created the blueprint which Canada followed. I think the difference between Canada and Uruguay, because Canada became the second country to formally, the second member state to formally legalize cannabis for non-medical uses. Canada was a bit more bold. They actually acknowledged that what they were doing was in non-compliance. But and they essentially made the same argument. They said, look, this is in the interest of our citizens. You know, we are following the guidance of the UN Charter in terms of peace and security and health and well-being of our citizens. And we will engage in a constructive debate in the relevant forums to try and resolve these tensions. And they kind of left it there. And the INCB got a bit pissy and sent a few snarky letters to both Uruguay and Canada and other countries now that are following in their footsteps. But essentially, there wasn't a great deal that the INCB could do apart from kind of a bit of finger wagging and kind of, you know, ooh, naughty, naughty, and give them a bit of a telling off in their annual report. You know, in many ways, that prohibitionist consensus and the treaties have been remarkably effective at maintaining global prohibition. But now the cracks are there. The first cracks in the dam, it's starting to turn into a flood. Mm-hmm. And now we're having five or six countries in Europe. We're seeing Thailand, South Africa, Mexico, and all these other countries. So once you have multiple countries defecting, then the whole system starts to collapse in its own internal projections, and something has to change. You know, either you get a new convention, yeah, or the conventions are repealed, or the conventions are amended, or something has to give. And I think that's the stage we're at now, particularly with the cannabis issue.
We'll be talking more after we hear this ad.
I bet you're smart.
Yeah, and you like to hold your own in the group chat.
We can help you drop even more knowledge. My name is Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Izadi. We host a daily news podcast called Post Reports.
Every weekday afternoon, Post Reports takes you inside an important and interesting story with the kind of reporting that you can only get from The Washington Post.
You can listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. Go find it now and hit follow.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Steve, you're reminding me that, you know, back in the old days when I was first speaking out in the late 80s, and one of our leading antagonists was the chairman of the U.S. Congress Select Committee on Narcotics, Charlie Rangel, very prominent black politician out of Harlem. And he was the one I was debating on national television, all this stuff. And he does a hearing. And part of his rhetorical thing is, well, what's your plan? What are you going to do? How are you going to sell it? How are you going to, I'm kind of imitating his kind of voice that he had back then, right? And I remember thinking, you know, is he actually serious about wanting to hear proposals? And I don't think he was. I mean, I sort of took the opportunity. I think, as you know, back when I was teaching at Princeton, I put together a Princeton working group on the future of drug use and alternatives to drug prohibition. I had 18 distinguished academics from about a dozen different disciplines to try to come up with a basic model of how do you think about legally regulating drugs? How do you find the right compromise between individual rights and community rights? The right compromise between putting a stake through the heart of the black market and organized crime, yet at the same time having a non-free market public health approach? How do you balance all that? But we didn't have that many models to go on. I mean, we could look at alcohol and tobacco to some extent, but it wasn't all that developed. But what I found was that when we put out our recommendations from the Princeton Working Group in an article I published in Daedalus 30 years ago in 1992, there was really no market for that. And what you did with Transform beginning about 15 years ago was really, one was you put this out with a level of sophistication and a level of depth that really nobody had done before. And secondly, in terms of the timing, there was the beginnings of a market for this. I mean, when you wrote the first blueprint for regulation, that was almost before that time, but you laid the groundwork. And obviously your volumes on regulating cannabis and stimulants are ever more timely in this front. Now, all of this goes to say that background issue of the United Nations, what I remember, this is what I want to ask you about, is 5, 6, 7 years ago, there was this vigorous and sometimes almost personal debate happening within the international drug reform community about how we should think about the conventions. And I remember there were people saying we have to focus just on getting rid of the conventions entirely and replacing them with something like maybe the WHO framework of tobacco control. And others would say that's unrealistic. Let's focus on revising the conventions and removing cannabis and maybe coca from the conventions. And then others would say, no, let's just do what the president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, did, where they withdrew from the conventions and then rejoined, making an exception. And others say, let's just do what Mojica did. Let's just ignore the conventions, essentially. But what's your take a few years after the fact now on that whole debate among the reformers and whether it was a productive debate or whether it really actually resulted in something concrete?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing to say is that it was really important to be having that debate, and it was to laying out these different potential pathways for reform of the UN system. You know, nothing really has significantly changed at the UN since the UNGAS in terms of the actual, you know, the legal foundations. I mean, the treaties are all still in place. There's been one minor tweak to scheduling of cannabis, which is now acknowledged to have some medical uses, but that's basically the only thing that's happened. But what has changed is that more and more states are saying publicly, and if you publicly in the UN forum, so these are things that would only have been said by Uruguay 10 years ago, but now you're getting 8, 10, 15 countries standing up and saying, these treaties are no longer fit for purpose. They are not meeting our needs, and they need to be reformed. And more countries are not just saying there is a need for change at the UN level, but they are actually just making reforms, you know, essentially in breach of their technical obligations under the treaties. So the water is building behind the dam, and at some point, something has to give. Now, exactly what the mechanism of that reform will be is unclear, but a tipping point will be reached, and I think we're approaching it fairly soon, particularly with cannabis, but perhaps with the whole treaty framework more broadly, where there is just an acknowledgement that the system is no longer working, and if it doesn't reform, it will simply collapse. And it's the treaty system, it's important to remind people that it doesn't just, you know, enforce prohibition, it also regulates controlled medicines globally. So, you know, the use of opioids and the use of various drugs, which can be misused non-medically, are also regulated by the treaties. And that it does, so it does have an important function that we would generally seek to maintain as well.
Now, Steve, there was one other historical thing. I mean, we're obviously talking, and we'll go more into this around cannabis and also what's happening now in Colombia around coke and cocaine. But there was also this little fascinating story that happened in New Zealand some years ago, right? Maybe 7-8 years ago, right? Where they were struggling with what to do about the problem of synthetic cannabis, and where two of the biggest producers of synthetic cannabis essentially approached the government, said, look, we have a mutual interest in your regulating synthetic cannabinoids. We know that our products are relatively safe. We don't like all these other, you know, fly-by-night operations putting out these products that can be quite dangerous. And the result was the New Zealand Parliament passing by like 100-1 margin a law essentially creating a domestic kind of like FDA, Food and Drug Administration, to regulate drugs that could be sold not for medical purposes. Yep. And there is giving producers, corporations, the opportunity to say, we have a product, we want to put it on the market for recreational purposes. And if we can prove that it's basically got a high margin of safety, the government will allow us to do so. So New Zealand moves forward with this thing. They pass this law. Unfortunately, it never gets implemented. But between the time it gets passed and enacted and the time it never gets implemented, there must have been some reaction in Vienna, in the headquarters of the United Nations, you know, narcotics system. And you were going to these meetings. I mean, every year, I think you and many others were going to the meetings in Vienna of the Commission on Narcotic Drugs. What was the reaction at that level? Because that was potentially a model for broader legalization.
It was. And I mean, it's interesting that the reaction was incredibly muted because those synthetic cannabis drugs at the time were not controlled under the UN conventions. I mean, we have the same, there is the same issue that countries have domestically, which is, you know, as these novel psychoactive substances are invented, they have to then get, essentially they have to get banned. They have to get scheduled or added to your the prohibitionist list. And that does happen at the Commission on Narcotic Drugs every year. A whole bunch of drugs are kind of read out and there's votes and they all get banned. But at the time, they weren't illegal, those New Zealand synthetic cannabinoids. And so there wasn't really any engagement. And also, the UN didn't really have a mandate to do anything about it until they were scheduled. And to be scheduled, countries have to report them and they have to go through this process. And the WHO has to produce a report. And it all takes quite a long time. All of those drugs have subsequently been banned, I should add now. But by that time, what was proposed in New Zealand had already kind of fallen to pieces. I mean, it's interesting that law did pass in New Zealand, and they do have this. It's still there. It's still on the books. They do have this really quite good, sophisticated regulatory framework, and I did some work on it, which it was very welcome in many ways. But no drugs ever made it into it. So it's like this empty shell of a legislation. And it was kind of a daft reason in the end, because they're to get the toxicology to establish the safety limits, you had to do animal testing. And they also had another law that said you can't do animal testing on these drugs. So they kind of they just got caught in this sort of legislative catch 22. Yeah. And I wouldn't want to see animal testing done on novel psychoactive substances either, but it was a bit of a shame that there wasn't an alternative route. But interestingly, in New Zealand, even before the Psychoactive Substances Act in 2016, I think it was, they did actually have a system put in place a few years before that, back in the 2000s, I think around 2008. They actually developed a regulatory framework for a specific drug called BZP, which was a kind of crappy low rent stimulant drug, you know, and it was being widely sold as one of these legal highs, you know, as one of these novel psychoactive substances that wasn't covered by the law. It became really quite popular in New Zealand, and they did actually put a regulatory framework and in their legal system for the regulation of this one specific drug. So for a couple of years in New Zealand, and this was years before the Psychoactive Substances Act, they did actually have a regulatory framework for the sale of this this crappy stimulant called BZP. And you know, it was sold legally, and there was you know, quality control, and you had to have dosage put on the packaging, and a lot of the things that we'd like to see. It wasn't brilliant, but it was all right. And it was actually the first that I'm aware of, the first legal regulatory framework anywhere in the world for a drug outside of the conventions that was a synthetic stimulant drug. So that happened. It then fell foul of some sort of political shenanigans and was eventually repealed and banned along with everything else. But New Zealand does have this sort of interesting history. And they of course, it was only like 2 years ago, they narrowly missed legalizing cannabis in a national referendum by about, you know, a handful of votes. I think it was about half a percentage point that their national referendum. Sadly, they just failed on that. So we're not going to see cannabis legalization in New Zealand, not for a few years anyway, but I'm sure it will happen someday.
That was the one where the prime minister wouldn't say whether she was for it or against it, and then afterwards said, "Oh, I voted for it, but I didn't want to buy it."
Yeah, and I wish she'd just said, if she'd said that, probably would have swung it. But I think it was about 60,000 votes in the end. They just narrowly lost. But you know, the fact that it even made it to a referendum, and the fact that it was that close, just goes to show how far we've come.
Steve, let me just interject to say that oftentimes when people ask me about legalization, how do I define it? How do I distinguish from decriminalization? I say, you know, legalization essentially means the legal regulation of this market, like we have with alcohol and tobacco products. And so in a way, I look at Mexico and South Africa and say, well, okay, the courts rule that way. But until you actually have the government legally regulating shops, or at least stores being up and selling without being, even if they're not regulated, them being up and selling openly without the police having any basis to crack down on them. In Mexico and South Africa, you still don't have stores popping up openly selling cannabis products without fear of any prosecution or arrest.
No, you're in a kind of limbo legal transition state in those two countries.
In a limbo. But basically, in Malta, legally regulated shops selling
cannabis.
Not quite.
So what they did in Malta is interesting in that they have legalized home growing within certain parameters, a certain number of plants, and if you follow certain rules. And they've legalized what in Spain is kind of called cannabis social clubs. So not-for-profit cooperatives that are membership-based. So you can join a membership-based cooperative, and then there will be a specific cannabis grown for that cooperative to be supplied to the members of that cooperative on a not-for-profit basis. But they have not actually opened yet. So they're only opening for license applications for these non-profit associations next month. So that you can't yet actually go and buy cannabis anywhere. And even if you wanted to, you'd have to be a resident of Malta and you'd have to join one of these associations. And then you would be able to have access to legal cannabis via that route, unless you were growing your own at home. So they're not going to have any actual retail commercial market as such at all, only these non-profit cannabis associations. So it's kind of an interesting a model. You know, this is a fascinating time for drug policy folks, because you're seeing these more commercial models in the US, you're seeing kind of these state models in state control models, like in Uruguay, and certain and state-controlled retailing in places like Quebec in Canada. But now you're seeing these European models emerging, and this interesting one in Malta, where there isn't going to be a commercial retail market at all, only home-growing and not-for-profit associations. So we're going to be really interesting to see what works and what doesn't work with these models. You know, what can we learn from for countries that follow in their footsteps?
Well, now, Uruguay was kind of interesting, right? Because they did basically a tripartite model, right? Where they said, basically, you can grow your own up to a certain point, which is a core element of what's going on in the U.S. Then they did some of the Spanish cannabis social club model, so people could have a kind of cooperative where people were a member and somebody would grow for the group. And then they did a pharmacy sort of distribution model. And now that's been going on for about almost, eight years now. I mean, how's it working out? And are we seeing a lot of, I mean, is the pharmacy the principal source? What's happened with the black market there?
I mean, the black market, the illegal market has certainly contracted. But interestingly, the pharmacy sales, which were probably too restrictive, and they have not actually turned out to be the predominant supply model. So far more people obtain their cannabis through home growing or through the not-for-profit social clubs than via the pharmacies. And I think the problem really with the pharmacies was that they were just too restrictive. You have to register as a registered buyer to get a kind of digital passcode thing so that you can buy a certain amount each month. And the cannabis that they sell is quite low potency, certainly by American standards. I think you can get 7% and 9% THC, which a lot of people would regard as too low, or that if you're used to kind of 20% plus THC cannabis, you probably regard that as too weak. I think they're looking to now introduce a stronger strain of around 15%. But it was non-branded. There was only these two varieties you could get, these two potencies, and you could only get it from a relatively small number of pharmacies. And you had to buy in person, so you couldn't do mail order delivery. So for people who weren't near one of these pharmacies, it was actually pretty inaccessible. And a lot of people were turned off from using this. You know, they didn't want to register with the government as someone who uses cannabis for kind of unsurprising, obvious reasons. People don't want to be on a government database as people who use cannabis, given you know, the history of the war on drugs and persecution of cannabis users. So actually, about 10 times more cannabis is consumed from home grow and the social clubs than actually the pharmacy sales model, which suggests to me that the pharmacy sales model was too restrictive. I think you probably, you know, even for someone like me, who I know, Ethan, you're always teasing me about being a hyper regulator, I think they overcooked it. I mean, I was involved in making proposals and helping design some of this, but I was down there with Lisa Sanchez, who's now the director of MUCD in Mexico. And we were saying, look, that's just it's too restrictive. You know, if you're having a registry of buyers, people aren't going to be into it. And I think we were proved right, because it just hasn't proved as popular, I think, as they were expecting. And people were much more drawn to the idea of these social clubs and homegrown models, because they just didn't want to be in the system. They didn't want that. They were worried about surveillance, right, and privacy.
Well, Steve, but it does seem, though, that for example, the import from Paraguay had dropped dramatically, if they're getting it illicitly, they're getting it diverted. They're getting it from home grows, from friends, or from social clubs, or what have you.
Yeah, and the stuff that was coming in from Paraguay was pretty terrible quality stuff, lots of sticks and seeds, and it was very low potency, and it often had pesticides on it. It was pretty crappy weed, really. And so the stuff that was being produced, even the low potency pharmacy stuff, and certainly the stuff from the social clubs, was just far, far better. But it was coming in at kind of the same price. So the Paraguay imports and that whole market, yeah, collapsed. And that is an undoubted positive in terms of reducing the scale of the illegal market. So to that extent, mm-hmm. it's been a success. I think in public health terms, it's been regarded as a success. Youth use, which is obviously always a focus of these debates, has you know, either stayed level or in many cases gone down. There certainly hasn't been a jump in levels of use. Adult use has gone up a bit like it has in some other legalization places. But, you know, the much dreaded explosion in cannabis use and, you know, armies of child cannabis zombies walking the streets, none of that stuff happened.
Let's take a break here and go to an ad.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
You don't have have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
So, Steve, we've been friends for 20 years. When it comes to thinking about legal regulation, we're actually pretty, on the big picture, we're pretty much on the same page. That you have to find ways of balancing public health and public safety and maximizing tax revenue, but protecting young people and, you know, respecting what communities want to do in terms of where things can be sold and limiting advertising and all this sort of stuff. But when push comes to shove, we also get into it. And Steve likes to tease me, calling me a libertarian, which, of course, I am not. I'm a civil libertarian, but I'm certainly, my politics lean left of center. And I like to tease him about being a hyper-regulating socialist, which of course is probably more true than anything he accuses me of being. But that's it. Steve and I were recently, in late 2022, at a gathering in the U.S. That was very focused on issues of social equity and racial equity and how to prevent the growing concentration in the marijuana and the cannabis industry in the U.S. and elsewhere. But I mean, Steve, I remember teasing you at this thing because a couple of interesting things were coming out of this. One is there were people not just from the U.S. there, but from about a dozen countries, and not just, you know, Europe, but Africa, the Caribbean, Latin America. And the first kind of, you know, kind of a realization that hit, that the people coming from Caribbean, Africa, Latin America, it suddenly occurred to them that they were looking at the U.S. as a potential market for them to be exporting their cannabis to, but that all the folks in the U.S. were going, well, wait a second, we don't want any exports. We want this to be all domestic driven. We want to help our small growers. And the second thing that was interesting was that some of the activists and small cannabis business owners there, you know, people of color running small marijuana businesses, if you closed your eyes and listened to them talking about the challenges they confronted, what jumped out at me was that here were women of color running small businesses, caring about equity, but for the first 60% of their comments, they could have been a Trump-loving small businessman Republican, right, complaining about overtaxation, overregulation, and realizing that what was killing, not, you know, you can hear the big guys, the multi-state operators, what we call the, you know, bigger cannabis organizations that have operations in lots of states complaining about overtaxation, overregulation, but to hear the little guys saying it and sounding like, even if our politics on the left and we care about equity, this is a major problem. And I wonder, Steve, in that meeting, I mean, you know, you've been a big advocate for high levels of regulation, taxation, all this sort of stuff. I mean, was there an aha moment for you there or anything surprising that jumped out at you there?
Yeah, I mean, one of the other things that came out was that there was a lot of fear of federal regulation, of federal legalization, which I was kind of surprised at. But I think there was a, I mean, one of the interesting things I think about the U.S., the way it's unfolded at the U.S., is that because regulation of cannabis is only operated within states. I mean, you can't have trade between states. You can have multi-state operators, but they have to operate, you know, within each state. So you've had these kind of now 21, I think it is, small scale, not small scale. Some of them are quite big scale. I mean, obviously California is huge, but you've had these kind of like islands of island industries that they can't trade with each other. But if federal legalization opens that up, I think there was a lot of fear of kind of corporate consolidation, and you would get these big kind of corporate players, and the smaller medium sized market actors wouldn't be able to compete with them in a national or in the future international market, and they would just get gobbled up or kind of brushed aside. And I think there was a very legitimate concern about that, and didn't really come up with that many answers, I don't think, because it's quite difficult. I think that there are potential answers, but it's important to try and protect the interests of the smaller medium sized businesses to prevent the emergence of oligopolies and monopolies who could sort of distort the market and consolidate the market in ways that, that I think would reduce diversity and reduce social equity. But there was also concerns that concerns about federal legalization having an impact on some of the really cool social equity programs that have been set up at state level, and that you know, we are seeing these things in Massachusetts and now New York and New Jersey and Illinois and a number of other states, really incredible social equity programs that would, you know, give licensing preference to social equity candidates from impacted communities, that would provide grants and support, that would, you know, could really help build and support people from impacted communities to participate in these markets in a meaningful kind of equal way, that federal legalization could kind of undermine a lot of those efforts if it's not done in a thoughtful way that respects the interests of some of these state social equity programs. So I was very struck by that. But I think the point you made, Ethan, about the international markets, I think that was really important, because even the people who...
Well, actually, Steve, before we get into the international market thing, I just want to say, you know, since I and my colleagues were deeply involved in the drafting of many of the medical marijuana and the marijuana legalization, you know, statutes, we look at what we were involved in California or Oregon, you know, 2014, 2016. I mean, obviously, we're learning a lot from that. You see in California, vast illicit market that continues, you know, because of overtaxation, overregulation, and a host of other variables. So the question about, when I look at some of your writing and your blueprints, right, they still have a strong regulatory, you know, a strong regulatory thing and tax and all this. Do you think that when you come out with your, you know, fourth edition of regulating cannabis, how do you think it'll be different in terms of what you see happening on the ground in many of these states and countries?
You know, if you read what we've said, Ethan, and I know you have done it. I hope it's a bit more nuanced. I mean, I would prefer to have, you know, localized and social controls and social norms dictating a lot of the things that we talk about. But what we've said is we think that as a starting point, you should err on the side of a more restrictive, more heavily regulated model. And then over time, as things are shown to be working okay, which bits are working, which bits aren't, you can then relax things. What I think is problematic is if you start with a very open market, a very maybe unregulated or underregulated market, it's much harder then to impose restrictions or regulations if things aren't working. And we've seen that with alcohol and tobacco. I mean, you know, you look at tobacco now, particularly in Europe, but also in the US, you know, it's been a decades-long battle to try and impose better regulation on tobacco in terms of marketing controls and in terms of information on packaging and in terms of, you know, smoking in public spaces and so on. When you've got a multi-billion-dollar entrenched industry lobbying against regulation, it's much harder to pursue public health goals in that context. So our view is that you start with a sort of public health regulation model and try and learn lessons from some of the failings of alcohol and tobacco. And if things are shown to be working, then you relax it afterwards rather than trying to do it the other way around. So I'm not into those things for the sake of it. I'm not a hyper-regulator just because love regulating stuff.
I get it. But and I basically agree. And the issue about corporate capture, when big alcohol, big tobacco can, you know, keep the taxes low and the regulations low for a long period of time. But to play devil's advocate on this stuff, right, it's also the case that if what you're trying to do to some extent is transition quickly from the illicit market, from the majority of the industry being illicit to being legally regulated, you want to have a low taxation policy, right? You want to find ways to induce people, you know, to shift from both consumers and producers to shift into
right.
a different
Well, it
type
comes
of
back
market,
to what you were
right?
talking about earlier, right? Ethan, this idea of balance. And one of the challenges we have when we have these policy debates, when we're designing regulatory frameworks, is you have a range of different stakeholders who have different priorities, and sometimes those priorities are in conflict with each other. Public health people generally, and tobacco tax is a good example of this, public health people generally want to have lots of tax, keep the prices of these things high, because most economic analysis shows that if you put the price up, people will consume less. And we've certainly seen that with tobacco. As you ramp up the tobacco taxes, use generally goes down. But what it also does is it incentivizes illegal market activity. Now, with tobacco, that's generally smuggling from lower tax regimes and selling it in high tax regimes, but some counterfeiting. But with cannabis, it means that you have a parallel illegal market that will seek to undercut the higher price, higher taxed cannabis products. And, you know, there's a tension there. You have a tension between the need to, a desire or a priority to dissuade use or certainly not encourage use by having low prices and dissuade use by having high prices, versus a desire from people who prioritize criminal justice outcomes to minimize the illegal market. And there's no perfect answer to that. We just have to decide what our priorities are and try and strike the right balance, acknowledging that, you know, you can't have it all. Different stakeholders have different priorities. And the problem, I think, is, and you've touched on this with the corporate capture thing, is that, you know, corporate actors and commercial actors whose primary goal is essentially profit generation, they will have a series of, you know, regulatory goals that may be at odds with the public health goals. You know, they are seeking to make money and not to protect public health. I'm not saying all corporate actors are totally uninterested in public health and other things like sustainability and social justice, but generally speaking, they will prioritize, you know, corporate profits over those other social health and, you know, sustainability goals. And there you have a tension. And if they become very powerful, and if you do get consolidation, and if you do have these billion-dollar corporations, you know, flooding the hill with their lobbyists and all the rest of it, it becomes very difficult for social justice advocates who don't have the same access to that kind of political and media and sort of publicity capital,
right,
and lobbying capital and, you know, PR budgets to compete with them. And it becomes very difficult. And I actually think it's huge credit to the non-government organizations that they have been able to, you know, hold their own against some of these corporate voices on the market. You know, whether it's the Drug Policy Alliance or Transform or people like Charlene Teitel at the Parabola Center, you know, who are making the argument, you know, critical of corporate capture and critical of some of the kind of over-commercialization, that they are able to hold their own against these corporations that have these gigantic budgets. And, you know, they're actually funding front organizations like CPIR. I can't even remember what CPIR is an anagram for, cannabis. It's funded by the alcohol and tobacco industry as to promote cannabis legalization that is shaped in the interests of the alcohol and tobacco industry, who want to, you know, move in and profit on that new industry. And it's really important that we push back against that, because if you have alcohol and tobacco industry money and big corporate money guiding the legislation at this early stage, federal legislation and state legislation, it will be made in their interests, in the interests of corporate profits, and not in the interests, to quote the UN treaties, of the health and well-being of you know, humankind. And
yeah,
that's a big concern and something we really
Steve,
need to watch
out. I have to say, it is complicated. Because I remember at this meeting that you and I are both at, I'm asking, so what are the models as more and more states are embracing more of an, you know, trying to give a head start and a leg up and assistance to the non-big players, you know, especially to people of color, to veterans, to women, to people who have, you know, remarkably, people who've had a marijuana conviction getting a head start on getting an opportunity to get a license. And if you ask, well, so what are the best models out there right now? And the sense I got from some of the conversations was that there were two models out there. One was a limited one in Oakland, California, with a fairly progressive government that seems to have found some way to provide, you know, kind of equity preferences. But the other one, fascinatingly, was Oklahoma, right? One of the reddest states in America, which has legalized medical marijuana. And it's now a wild west out there with almost no regulation. People, growers from California moving to Oklahoma, Oklahoma illegally supplying, you know, beginning to supply the rest of the country. But what's the case there is it's probably one of the least regulated states in the country. One result of which is that anybody who can spend like $2,000 or something to get a license can open up a medical cannabis shop, and it's very easy to get a medical cannabis ID. But the result is if you go, I'm told, if you go into a black neighborhood, odds are pretty good that it's going to be some black guy from the community who's got the local dispensary, right? So there are ways in which the kind of very low regulation sometimes can advantage the small guys as well, at least so long as we don't have federal legalization.
I mean, you know, I'm up for looking at that. Generally, I frown on that low levels of regulation like that. But that's not that I don't want, people who don't have access to significant amounts of capital to be able to participate in the market. I really do. I just think you have to use your equity models to support them. So you have other states have grant programs and, you know, interest-free loan programs and training programs to help people, you know, enable them to compete on a more even playing field with some of the more established actors. And, you know, New York just issued its first 38 licenses, I think last month, and they're all to social equity candidates. 8 of them were to non-profit actors, which I just think is absolutely amazing. And 40% of the tax revenue from the new legal cannabis market in New York is going to go back into impacted communities in terms of social programs, which I also think is amazing. Then in New Jersey, it's 70% of the tax revenue is going to be reinvested in impacted communities. Now, if you think about it, that is really amazing. That's really amazing in the US to have 70% of the tax revenue in an emerging market be reinvested in communities that have been disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs. I think that's absolutely remarkable. And it does bring up some real challenges of capitalism and how states operate.
I mean, look, I also have a kind of a whole panoply of views on this. On the one hand, I'm very proud. I mean, California, which we played a major role in drafting in 2016, has really pioneered some of these provisions about directing tax revenue to the communities that have been most harmed, about giving certain assistance to, you know, basically equity actors to get involved in this industry. And, you know, obviously it was my successors at Drug Policy Alliance who drove the New York legalization model. So in that sense, it's very, you know, I feel quite proud of what's happened. But then I ask myself, if your number one objective is increasing the amount of tax revenue that's going to go to communities that were harmed, you want this industry to grow quickly, right? But the slower you roll it out, the less tax revenue that there's going to be. That secondly, the more regulation you have, the harder it's going to be. I mean, one thing that advantages the big players in all of this is that they have expertise in dealing with government regulation. They have lawyers. They've oftentimes come from other industries where they've been involved in this. Whereas if you're starting up or you've previously been involved in the illegal side of the industry and not had, you know, any interaction with government regulators, right, then basically these are all barriers to the small guys getting better and better.
But it depends
on
the regulation model you go for. So, this is one of the really beautiful and exciting things about cannabis legalization regulation is that, you know, we get to design the market structure from scratch and we can make decisions around who participates, how and when. And you can preference smaller actors. You can restrict participation of bigger actors. You can prevent, you know, emergence. You can limit the number of licenses that any one actor can have. You can support and do preferential licensing for particular communities or participants. You can make these decisions and you can reshape the market in all kinds of interesting ways. And, you know, I genuinely think that it may have impact on other markets that are nothing to do with cannabis. Because, you know, imagine if you had 70% of the tax revenue from, I don't know, oil being directed into environmental, mm-hmm. you know, cause environmental sustainability. This is, you know, I don't want to be sort of ridiculously evangelical and idealistic about this, but these things do have the potential to help reshape how we think about markets, and commerce and entrepreneurship and, you know, community participation in a much broader way. I'd love to see some of these really innovative, amazing cannabis reforms having a kind of ripple knock-on effect far beyond drug markets.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I would like to see that happen too. There's also a major difference, though, between talking about where the tax revenue is directed to on the one hand and how one is going to regulate or create opportunities in the interest on the other. And to some extent, there can even be a conflict between those two things. It's nice to think that this could become a model for the future and that it could even survive federal legalization. On the other hand, we do know that there is an overwhelming force behind the basic nature of capitalism. capitalism, right? Capitalism, you know, especially, I mean, look, even when we look about, the illegal markets, those are kind of capitalism in its rawest form. But when we look at legal capitalism and the different varieties of capitalism, from social welfare capitalism to crony capitalism to free market capitalism to kleptocratic capitalism, I mean, most of the world is essentially capitalist. And we also tend to see that some movement towards concentration inevitably happens in most industries. So let me bring this down to a very concrete example. You are an advisor and you've played a role in Canada. Now, Canada doesn't have the types of state controls, I mean, in the same way, or limitations that we have in the U.S. You do have more of a national model in Canada. And what's your take about how Canada is evolving and what lessons can be learned for better or worse from what's happened in Canada?
Well, I mean, the state controls are over supply and trade. The individual provinces, the provincial controls, I should say, the individual provinces, they regulate retail, and you do have this quite interesting variation between the provinces in terms of several of the provinces have government monopolies on the retail. So Quebec, perhaps most high profile, I think, I can't remember the other one, New Brunswick, I think. And a couple of them have a mix of government stores and, you know, conventional commercial stores. And so there is actually quite an interesting amount of variation. Some of them have different age access. And some of them, like in Quebec also, they don't allow certain edibles. They don't allow the gummies and candy-based edibles. So again, we have this quite fascinating sort of laboratory of change where you can look at, you know, okay, what's working in each one. I mean, I think if you look at the Canada generally, I would say generally it's been a reasonable success. If you look at the public health outcomes, if you look at the tax revenue, I think there was certainly a problem with the big corporate actors.
Let me just ask you quickly, what about...
Corporates have kind of collapsed in value. There was probably a bit of a bubble in terms, an investor bubble, which then collapsed. And the corporatization, I was very worried that we were moving towards a sort of oligopoly situation. And there was a point early on where I think the big five companies, they were all measured in the billions, valued in the billions, and they were... more than half of the total market. But interestingly, that has actually shrunk. A lot of them have kind of collapsed to a certain extent, your Tilray's and your, I can't remember what they're all called. But
let me interrupt you on two issues then. One is, when it comes to cultivation, can you have mega cultivation facilities in one province exporting to the rest of the country
in
Canada?
Yes, you can, yeah.
And secondly, and so that seems to me very different than what's going on in the U.S. Yeah. right now. And that means that you could potentially have major concentration where something like we've had, you know, where people envision if you under federal legalization that the Central Valley in California could be exporting to much of the
you
rest
can,
of the
but
country.
We can, we can make the rules. If you're writing the legislation, you get to make the rules. And if you say no one company can cultivate more than X hectares of cannabis, then that is then the law. And so
But has Canada done that?
No, they haven't. I mean, I actually wish that they did. I recommended that they did, and they didn't. So, I made some recommendations to work with the federal task force. Well, I didn't actually draft the law.
I understand. And what about in terms of corporate concentration? I mean, obviously, a lot of these companies grew too fast. They were too full of themselves. They collapsed. But what prevents corporate concentration
Not
in Canada?
Not very much. It's another thing that I think that they didn't do enough on. There has been a consolidation and corporate capture up to a point, but the point I was just making was that actually the system, the market seems to have actually in the last couple of years become more diverse and not less, which kind of has surprised me, but that's what the data suggests. I think some of the points you were making earlier that, you know, one of the things that Canada didn't do well was the social equity piece. They really didn't. They've had to kind of retrospectively try and introduce some social equity stuff, particularly related to participation of Indigenous groups. And, you know, the regulatory bars to entry to the market were way too high, even for their kind of micro cultivation. You needed to have literally hundreds of thousands of dollars. You had to build your facility before you could even apply for a license, which was, you know, crazy. So I think they didn't do some of the stuff around social equity at all well, but I get the sense that they acknowledge some of those shortcomings and are trying to kind of retrospectively kind of engineer in some more social justice stuff and more social equity programs. particularly around indigenous participation and micro-cultivation. But, you know, other countries can see, can look at what's happened in the US states. They can look at what's happened in Canada nationally and at a provincial level and learn from that and go, well, look, they did this really well. I mean, things like, you know, quality control, inspections, packaging regs and so on. Generally, I think all of that stuff, health warnings and tax controls, I think generally was pretty good. And you're seeing about 60% of the market is now taxed and regulated in Canada after 5 years, sorry. And you know, it's been creeping up. It was 30% after 1 year, then 50% after like 2 or 3 years, and now it's about 60%, and it's still going up. Now, 60%, you know, it would be a lot better if that was 80 or 90%, but that's still 60% taxed and regulated, as opposed to 100% illegal and untaxed and unregulated, which is what it was before 2018. So it's still huge progress. I think generally they've done a good job, but there were shortcomings.
The question you and I are both mutually interested in, is there any way to kind of get to the point of diversity and diversification and avoiding the conglomeration of wealth and the oligopoly phenomenon, you know, without having the big guys take over in the first place? And the question is, can that realistically happen? Can it really happen given the power of economics in all of this, and given the realities of politics in all of this, and given the fact that, you know, a big part of the U.S. government is controlled by Republicans who don't care about a lot of this type of thing that you and I are talking about, right? And as you say, when you talk about NAFTA and WTO and all these other sorts of variables. So the question is can in fact that happen? And one of the things I find myself saying, people who are pursuing equity objectives, especially at the governmental level, is try to think forward 5 or 10 years. Take everything we know about the forces that lead to concentration and to oligopoly takeover, and try to figure out what are the things that can effectively be blocked. How do you take a stand in certain areas where you can preserve things that are meaningful? And I think we need to look at the lessons from other industries. I mean, you know, if you look at alcohol, I was just looking the other day, Steve, at which states allow liquor to be sold in supermarkets. And I think like a third to a half of all U.S. states now allow liquor to be sold in supermarkets. And they vary from, conservative states to moderate states to liberal states all around the country. There's no kind of rhyme or reason to that. And I think that in those states where liquor can be sold in supermarkets, you're less likely to have small liquor stores, right? Small wine stores and things like that. So I'm curious, is that how much of you and others, are they looking at the viable models from alcohol control that make sense? Or if we're looking in the global context, looking at the models for, say, coffee production or cacao production, the ones that have been successful in retaining, you know, a real diversity of participation on the cultivation and the distribution side, as opposed to having oligopoly take over. Which elements of industry are the ones where you can best resist oligopoly, whereas which elements of industry are the ones where it's inevitable, and therefore you figure out how to kind of canalize, how to direct that stuff so you can protect the small guys without ever thinking you can ultimately block it. But in terms of going forward, and as we think not just about cannabis, as we think about the legal regulation of coca and hopefully cocaine, as we think about MDMA, things like that, how much do you know about people looking at these other models, whether the alcohol field or the cacao and coffee field on the production side? Is that thinking happening or not? And if not, why not?
I think it is. I mean, we've been trying to get people in sustainable development and social and sustainable development goals, people in the development field, engaged in the drug policy debate, specifically around, you know, alternative to prohibition and what legal markets for some of these drug plant crops would look like, and how we can build in things like sustainable development and fair trade principles and, you know, protecting traditional growers. A lot of these concepts have been thought about, you know, organizations like the Transnational Institute in the Netherlands have done a lot of work. Health Poverty Action in the UK have done a lot of work. Transform have been pushing it. And a lot of the things that you've already touched upon, you know, learning lessons from successful fair trade approaches to other agricultural products. But, you know, at a domestic level, I think you can do anti-monopoly legislation. You can do an awful lot with licensing controls. You know, you can say, no individual economic actor can take more than X number of licenses, and you aren't allowed to have vertical integration. You can't own production and retail facilities. You can actually do a lot to prevent those things at the initial legislative stage. And if it's hardwired into the legislation at the outset, it's not something that will necessarily just get eroded in time. I mean, of course, legislation can be amended or superseded. But if you don't allow the emergence of these, you know, ultra powerful multi-billion pound corporations in the first instance, then, you know, those power blocks of lobbying and political influence don't emerge either. So you don't have to then try and retroactively impose responsible regulation and control like we've had to do with alcohol and tobacco. We've done successfully with tobacco to some degree, but we haven't really done with alcohol yet, which is why I would argue that alcohol is critically underregulated in many ways, particularly around retail and marketing and corporate sponsorship and so on. But I just think there's a lot we can do. And if you are actually in the position of making the reforms and drafting the legislations which shape the nature of the market from the outset, you have the power to do things very differently. And that's why you do have the possibility of social equity programs that restrict licensing or preference licensing for impacted communities. And you are able to legislate that 40% or 70% of tax revenue is redirected into impacted communities. And you can put in place controls that prevent certain actors from participating. You can actually do it. You can design and have markets operate in a different way at a legislative level from the outset. And of course, then there are also options like state monopolies. So in a number of, as I've already said, in a number of Canadian provinces, you do have state monopolies on retail. In Quebec, all of the cannabis shops are run by the provincial government of Quebec. And this, it's a bit like the alcohol model in some Nordic countries, which in Sweden, for example, all alcohol retailing is run by a state monopoly of the Swedish government. Or you can have a very strictly regulated, effectively a state monopoly model on production as well, as they've done in Uruguay. Or you can have non-profit and home-growing only, as they've done in Malta. So there are alternatives. There are different ways of doing this. We don't have to go down an alcohol and tobacco model. And it used to annoy me when you would talk about, you know, let's legalize and regulate cannabis like we do alcohol, and let's tax and regulate cannabis like alcohol. And I go, no, let's do it better than that. Don't keep saying that, Ethan. Let's do it better than that. Let's learn from all the crappy stuff we've done with alcohol regulation, and not do that and do it better. Let's use cannabis regulation as an opportunity to show how drugs can be regulated and how markets can be regulated in the interests of the communities in which those markets exist, because rather than in the narrow interest of governments or in the narrow interest of corporate profits, which is the way that a lot of markets have gone up to now. And that operates at a local level, it operates at a state level, at a national level, at a regional level, and at an international level. So we have to be thinking about these intersecting issues that operate at different scales, as well as the issues themselves. So social justice and social equity and fair trade are important principles, but they operate at all different scales. And some of there may be tensions between, you know, local level initiatives, national level initiatives, and international initiatives. This stuff is complicated. You know, there's a lot of work to be done, even if we get the principles in place, and even if the political will and intent is there, actually delivering these things effectively in ways that can last. You know, as you say, a lot of these things may be vulnerable. We can have all these good intentions, and then a few years down the road, you know, corporate capture and corporate consolidation has eroded a lot of this stuff. We have to put in place solid legislation that can stand the test of time, deliver stuff that deliver outcomes that communities want to see, and therefore communities and the politicians that serve them will be supportive of these initiatives in the longer term. I mean, I genuinely believe it's doable. And I think a lot of the examples that are emerging already, whether it's in Uruguay, whether it's in Malta, whether it's in some of the better models that have emerged in US states and Canadian provinces, we're doing that already. We're showing how things can be done better, because legalization is a process. Regulation is the endpoint, but there is more than one way to do it. You can do it well, or you can do it badly. And I think advocates such as us who've been pushing for reform all these years, we need to be advocating for legalization regulation to be done right. And when it's not done right, I think we have to speak up against it. And it pains me sometimes to be critical of some of the legalization models that are emerging. But I think it was it in Ohio where they had this awful model with where basically they were having a constitutional monopoly for the people who funded the ballot initiative, where these 10 named people would then get basically a monopoly on the legal cannabis market. And I had to come out against it.
But Steve, listen, I did want to give you the last word on this, but quite frankly, that was a wonderful summation that you just presented. And I overwhelmingly, of course, in the end, you know, I've been on record for a long time as saying I'm not in this for the Budweiserization or Marlboroization of marijuana. I really believe in a small is beautiful model, and I'd like to see that work. And I hope that we can actually make
that work in effective ways. The next fight. We've won the first. We've won the argument for against prohibition. Now the next battle is to make sure that regulation and legalization regulation is done in the right way. That supports the principles that we fought for all along.
But on that very optimistic and promising note, I want to bring our extended conversation to a halt. I want to thank you, Steve, for being such a wonderful ally throughout many decades and continuing into the future, and a good friend, and for being a real thought leader, and not just a thought leader, but somebody who's had an impact on the way government shapes these policies and bringing the right set of values to thinking about all of this. And also thank you for being, you know, episode number 80 to conclude season 2 of Psychoactive, and hopefully it'll not be the last episode of Psychoactive ever, but I'm very glad that you got to be the final guest that we've had in this current incarnation of Psychoactive.
Well, thank you, Ethan. It's been a privilege to work with you over all these years, and it's been fun coming on the show, and I hope it isn't the last one.
I hope so too. Okay, Steve, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
If you're enjoying Psychoactive, please tell your friends about it. Or you can write us a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners. If you'd like to share your own stories, comments, and ideas, then leave us a message at 1-833-779-2460. That's 833-PSYCHO-0. Or you can email us at psychoactive@protozoa.com or find me on Twitter at Ethan Nadelman. You can also find contact information in our show notes. Psychoactive is a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. It's hosted by me, Ethan Nadelman. It's produced by Noam Osband and Josh Thane. The executive producers are Dylan Golden, Ari Handel, Elizabeth Giesis, and Darren Aronofsky from Protozoa Pictures, Alex Williams and Matt Frederick from iHeartRadio, and me, Ethan Nadelman. Our music is by Ari Belusian, and a special thanks to Avivit Bar-Yosef, Bianca Grimshaw, and Robert Beebe.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.